Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ. It is chilly in southern DMZ. It is crisp, and I am. This is the first week I've worn sweaters. So,
I'm wearing a sweater right now. Northern DMZ below 40 this morning.
That is getting chilly, my friend.
But it's a bumper apple crop in Western Mass this year. So if you're coming up to check out some foliage, do some organic apple picking, you know, it's the time is right.
Well, you know, I am a fan of the farmers markets, Bill.
So just the market yesterday, got some last round of raspberries. A big tomato season up here. I just made my own ketchup.
Oh yeah, you tweeted? Did you tweet a picture or put it on Facebook?
I just put it on Facebook. Homemade ketchup is it's not hard, little time consuming, but much more flavor and much less sugar.
And fun. And did you incorporate the kids in this project?
I haven't yet. I mean, it really is, you know, putting a pot of tomatoes on the stove with a ton of vinegar and having it simmer for 6 hours. You know, there's only so much, I mean, with the occasional stir. So it's not too much for the kids to do. Both of my kids, well, my four-year-old does not like ketchup. So I can't get her to try yet. My 1.5-year-old, she was dipping her broccoli in it. So that there's some success there.
Yes. Well, I think it's great that you do that, and I wish, you know, we need to do that. This is just a great time of year, though, too. I mean,
you go to the markets. You haven't gone farm share yet, if I'm correct.
We haven't gone that far yet. We do go to the farmer's market. This past weekend, we normally go to the Alexandria Farmer's Market. This past weekend, to celebrate my birthday, the wife and I stayed in D.C. overnight and walked to the DuPont Farmers Market, the best, the greatest of the farmers markets, I believe, in the D.C. area, which is on Sunday, not Saturday, not a normal day. So, but it's just a great time of year. You got the apple pie, the pumpkin pie, you got the football, you got the baseball playoffs, you got, you know,
Osterholz Grand Final.
It's the best. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
When you go farm share, the difference between farmers market and farm share is when you're in a farm share, you get what you get.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get to choose so much. And so when you have, you know, pick your own tomatoes, you just get a lot of tomatoes. And then you bring them home, you're like, what the hell am I going to do with all these tomatoes? And so my wife said she does the lion's share of it. She makes a ton of tomato sauce. We put it in the freezer and we use it all year long. And whatever's left over, I use for the ketchup. So,
I think it's great, Bill. And look, this is that we've had this CrunchyCon discussion before, but I believe that we should all be doing this. If you have the time, if you can do it, it's a project. It's for the family. There's just something spiritual, wholesome about making your own food and. Mm-hmm. Being closer or at least locally grown. I mean, there's something really nice about it. And I don't see why it's liberal or conservative. at the very least, it should be conservative. But
well, it's getting back.
It is weird, though. I've been out to places, you know, I was a couple years ago out in western Kansas, Dodge City, in fact. And that, you know, that's the breadbasket or you know, that's the heartland. But nobody eats any, you know, I guess it's probably more cattle than vegetables. Cause like nobody, and I lived in North Dakota for a while too. Same thing. Like, there's all these farms, but nobody eats farm food. Like it's all like processed. Most people eat processed food. Nobody, you know, I don't say nobody, but few people, you would assume that they're close to these farms and, that they would have all this fresh produce and whatnot. Not really the case. Not the case.
Well, I agree with you. It brings families together. It teaches your children about where food comes from and all that good stuff. We're not seeing a lot of family friendly behavior in Southern DMZ. It doesn't seem like Congress is feeling any kind of kumbaya moment right now.
No, but look, you could argue, and it has been argued, that nothing's more patriotic than gridlock, and we have a system of checks and balances, and ambition pit against ambition, and that, you know, you're not supposed to be able to ram things through. But it is interesting, and it is contentious, and
There's no moment in your history class where you celebrate the great gridlock of 1923 or anything like that.
Right. Well, we're biased toward action, and, you know, that could be potentially a problem. But, Bill, I have come to an interesting conclusion here. As you know, for the past years, I've been arguing for conservative policies, but to do things, you know, strategically and what I, from my perspective, smartly. And so I've challenged, for example, the people who want to defund Obamacare. I would love to defund Obamacare, but I've tried to argue that this is a fool's errand. You can't do it, and it's going to hurt Republicans. It's going to hurt their chances to win midterms, which will make it really tough to actually repeal Obamacare by winning the Senate and the presidency. So I've been sort of, a voice within conservatism trying to take on some of the forces within conservatism. And I have decided, Bill, that what I'm doing is a form of protectionism. And I've been treating the Republican Party like it's too big to fail. And what I should do is allow it to fail. Because if it's going to fail anyway, why, let's just get it over with. So go ahead.
So in the Matt Lewis creative destruction plan.
Right.
Have you gamed out what happens in, you know, step one, step two, step three, or it's just, you know, we're just going to see where it goes?
Well, there's this thing, creative destruction, which you've probably heard of, Schumpeter. So I'm being a little bit facetious here, but I have sort of gotten to the point now where I'm sick of fighting, and let them have their way. Let's see what happens. And in all honesty, though, Bill, I mean, even though I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek here, it may be, you've predicted that Republicans are, that parties have to lose three elections before they change. It really may be that that Republicans have to sort of hit rock bottom before they straighten up. And I'm not arguing for moderation or being more liberal. I mean, I'm arguing for being conservative. So it's not a matter of, like, that I think it's really a style thing and a strategy thing, not an ideology thing.
Can you explain?
It may just be that we need to let them have their way. I will shut up now,
though. Oh, okay. I just feel like you're in the heart of the Washington conservative movement. You're in the office of the Daily Caller. You talk to conservatives day in, day out. I feel like from outside that vantage point, it's just a head scratcher why there is this faction that seems oblivious to the argument that trying to take everything hostage in order to force the president and the Senate Democrats to repeal his signature legislative accomplishment is a wise tactic. And as you discuss this with folks coming from a conservative voice, talk to other conservatives about this, I mean, can you explain, is it rational? Is it irrational? It's hard to grapple with why so many people in Washington would take it this far when the odds of success are nil.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are several reasons for this. It's not irrational. There are several reasons why this is happening. I think that there are a lot of conservatives who are really frustrated with the fact that they elect Republicans. This is from their standpoint. They elect Republicans who go to Washington and fail to get the job done. They see a country that is becoming more and more liberal, that they're losing their country, And they see that something like Obamacare, which is pretty unpopular nationally, let's be honest, and was sort of rammed through in a pretty unseemly way, it's unpopular. And they've elected these Republicans to do whatever it takes to stop it. They see government gets bigger no matter what happens, and they've elected these Republicans to finally stand up and stop the growth of government, not to go along to get along, but to be warriors. And a lot of them say, look, if it hurts our image, so what? Take a stand, be a warrior. Some of these folks, I don't think, fully understand the details. Like, a lot of them probably believe that they actually can defund Obamacare. They haven't thought through, well, it has to pass the Senate and that Obama would veto it and that it's a fool's errand. All they know is that they're losing their country. It's getting more and more. Government's growing no matter who we send to Washington. And it's time that we've elected some of these people. They need to stand up and do what's right, whether it costs us or not. So they're making sort of a calculated decision here, stand on principle, let the chips fall where they may. And you can respect that. There's also, and there was a piece in First Things yesterday that I wrote about at my Daily Caller blog, at First Things, written by an associate professor and a department head at Texas A&M University, who argues that when it comes to, for example, the debt ceiling, that I'm going to walk you through this because it's a little bit complicated, but his theory is that by the time it's time to raise the debt ceiling, it would be irrational not to, because not doing so would create a default. But because everyone knows that it would be irrational not to raise the debt ceiling, that incentivizes earlier on in the process spending, because you can spend earlier knowing that nobody would ever dare not raise the debt ceiling. Therefore, for Republicans and conservatives to get things back in line, they have to either be irrational or at least feign being irrational, so that they send the message that, look, we are crazy enough to not raise the debt ceiling. If the Democrats believe that, that will disincentivize spending earlier in the process. I'm not endorsing this theory, but you asked me to explain it. And that, you can go to my blog at the Daily Caller or go to First Things, and you can read this. Now, my argument is, like, look, you know, not raising the debt ceiling is shutting the barn door after the horse is out. Why can't we elect conservatives to go to Washington and hold the line on spending, you know, before we spend it?
Well, keep in mind that has happened. You elected conservatives that have brought about the sequester, which is
right.
Real spending cuts. Yeah. And why isn't there any kind of acknowledgement that, okay, maybe we didn't win this battle, but we're winning this battle over here. And, you know, we lost Medicare and Social Security and the Republic still stands. Some things you lose and you try to fight another day somewhere else. Why does it have to be that if you don't do an Alamo on Obamacare, all is lost?
Well, I think that there are several reasons for that. I think that Obamacare is a really, really big deal. I oppose it on principle, just being, you know, mandating that you have to purchase something. I still believe, regardless of what John Roberts may have decided, that it was a tax or whatever, I still argue that it's unconstitutional. So it's understandable, and it's a huge thing. It's an example of America changing and becoming less free, and you could argue more secure, but it's an argument between that tension. So it's a big loss, and it's understandable that conservatives would sort of have that in the craw. But I do think that there is not an appreciation for the long game, the things that are getting better, but especially the long term. So I think that you could definitely argue that, look, you know, you've got Rubio and Cruz and Toomey and Lee, this really sea change in the U.S. Senate with conservatives who have come in the last, you know, few years, let them, give them some time to change things. And if you lose, you lose. But there's a sense that rather than fighting over the future, that you want to sort of hold things up procedurally. And that, look, I mean, I'm not opposed to that always. I do think that, you know, you elect congressmen and members of Congress, and they have, you know, they have responsibility over how things can work procedurally. But there does seem to be an emphasis not on voting rights, but on sort of jamming up the works, the cogs, the machinery.
Well, that's what I feel like. I think there's a lack of intellectual consistency among these people. I mean, they are not applying the same logic to Obamacare, to Medicare and Social Security. They've never said, if you don't repeal Medicare today, which is, you know, a far bigger government program than Obamacare is, and they're both think it's unconstitutional, thought it was the pathway to socialism, and they say about Social Security too. No one has ever on the right ever said, if you don't repeal this entire program today, I'm going to shut down the whole joint. They've been more creative about it. They've said, okay, why don't we propose private accounts? Why don't we propose Medicare Advantage? Why don't we do the Ryan Medicare premium support? They've gone at it a whole myriad of different ways. I mean, granted, they haven't worked very well either, but they still push it. I mean, there are folks that still push those things and don't make it a hostage matter. So why can't you be just as principled a warrior and go at it on policy grounds and not just be interested in gumming up the works? I feel like there's something in the DNA here where they just want to gum up the works. It's fun to gum up the works. It's kind of a you know, 8-year-old mindset, I feel, but I feel like that's
what
they're
doing. I also think it's a revolutionary idea. It's a revolutionary idea, which basically says that what you want. Here's the thing. I think that we've had this influx of libertarian leaning conservatives who have read too much Heinlein and Rand and frankly Sullivan.
I was going to say.
And I think that they romanticize this, and they envision themselves as not statesmen as much as revolutionaries. And if you're trying to overthrow a government, literally, you want to make it like really inefficient and really ineffective. And I think that's part of what this is. As much as I don't like Obamacare, I think part of the problem with that is that, this becomes sort of a game of one-upmanship, you know, like an arms race. So it's not, you know, I don't buy the theory that Republicans are worse than Democrats at this. I mean, you know, that's certainly a theory advanced. I mean, I just had Thomas E. Mann on, you know, he has this book out that talks about it. But I think that the thing that happens is that we end up maybe having a political culture where whatever side is in charge, the other side doesn't so much become the loyal opposition as trying to sort of, you know, stick, you know, something in the spokes.
So just to tie up this conversation, you know, you think it's not going to work, but you're going to stand back and let the train wreck happen. What do you think follows?
Well, I suspect that, I mean, you know, there are going to be people fighting this, like whether or not I say go for it. So then there's the question as to whether or not. So here's the problem, right? So let's say that the effort to defund Obamacare doesn't work. The excuse could be, Yeah, because Republicans weren't on, not enough Republicans were on board. They didn't have the guts to, you know, to really, there's always going to be that asterisk, you know? But, you know, going back to the original premise, I mean, I do think it would be, you know, let these ideas, which I think are quixotic, let them try them. Because it may be that we have to go, like, okay, the readers, you know, the commenters don't like my football analogies. Screw them. It's week three. You're going to get them because I think more about football than politics at this time of year. There's that thing where you're trying to rebuild a football team. And in football, in the NFL, you're not allowed to have rebuilding years because the stakes are so high, especially if you're in a big market city. But let's be honest. I mean, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers, you know, aren't what they used to be, right? And then there's the question, like, are you better off trying to win, if, you know, you got to win, say you got to win 10 games to make it to the playoffs, right? 10 out of 16. But let's say that if you try really hard and put some glue and, you know, some gum on, you know, you can sort of like jerry rig it and you could still win 7 or 8 games. Or you can let the damn thing fall apart, draft the next great, you know, Heisman Trophy winning quarterback, and in 2 or 3 years be in the Super Bowl. And so that's like a debate you have to wrestle with. Like, are, you know, do we owe it to the fans to try to field the best team today, which means we're going to be average for the next decade? Or are we just going to, like, Ben Roethlisberger's had his time, let's trade him, he's getting all, you know, I'm not saying he is, but you get my point.
Right.
Let's bring in, I mean, okay, this happened in Indianapolis, where they let Peyton Manning go, which now looks very ill-advised. But, you know, these things happen where you have teams that make strategic decisions. A better example would be in Green Bay, where they let Brett Favre go, which at the time was controversial, because Favre ended up having a couple good years, took the Vikings to the playoffs. But they let Favre go because they had Aaron Rodgers. And so the Packers took a step back for a year. They weren't as good. But now they have this, you know, quarterback who is, you know, arguably the best quarterback in the NFL and will be for another decade, possibly. So, you know, if you're looking at this, you know, are you better off letting this team kind of fall apart and rebuild? Or do you try with all your might to hold it together to get a few more wins to, you know, I mean, I know the stakes are much higher in politics, but, you know, forgive me for the sports analogy.
So in the Matt Lewis plan, just give it to Rand Paul for 2016. Give it to Ted Cruz. Let him drive it into the ground. Look for 2020.
Well, no, I mean, look, 2016 is a few years away. I mean, I'm saying, you know, first of all, it's, you know, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there's some truth to this. Let's just, you know, it doesn't have to be 2016. I'm not saying, you know, but... okay, you wanted to fund Obamacare? Go for it. Do it. And I say you can't. I'd love for you to do it, but I say you can't, and I say it's going to hurt us. You say you can, and that I'm overwrought. Okay, I surrender. Go do it. If you think you can defund Obamacare, I'd love to see you do it. Go do it. And we'll see who's right. And I hope I'm wrong. I hope you do it. I hope it doesn't hurt conservatives. Just go for it. And then if you fail, then we will know where you stand. We will know not to trust you next time. And, you know, look, let's be honest. I mean, a lot of the people ginning up these things are doing it to raise money for, you know, this is great business. It was a quote, you know, if it starts off as a movement, turns into a business and ends up as a racket. There's a lot of people making money off of getting, you know, really well-intentioned conservatives around the country to donate $25 to stand by whomever in this cause, which, again, I support in theory, but strategically I don't think it can work. So Let's talk about your guy.
Well, I was going to say, your leadership strategy there is kind of leading from the sidelines. But you're being very hard on Obama's leadership strategy in the wake of the Syria deal.
Yeah, well, he's elected president, in fairness. Not, they wouldn't, you know,
You are a pundit, which makes you America's national treasure.
This is true. But look, you know, Bill, I think Obama, we had a big, you know, we should go back and revisit. We had, during his inauguration, we had a show. I think we talked about all the difficulties of second-term presidents and why second terms, even among presidents we highly regard, are usually pretty much a waste. And I think it's fair to say that Barack Obama is off to a very, very, very poor start. And we always said he only has a couple, you know, he only has like, you know, 18 months maximum to get anything done anyway before he's a complete lame duck. I think it's been a complete disaster. And
with a small caveat that if Republicans crash and burn over this, they might get an extra 2 years after the midterms. But generally speaking, yes.
Let's let him do it and see what happens. And you know, this is what I think. I guess what I'm arguing for there is the rebuilding. You know, the youth movement. Let's look to the future. But look, the latest example, and Morning Joe's been harping on this, was we had this shooting in D.C. And you know, the D.C. I mean, you know, there was chaos here. I mean, you know, it was, you know. People, they were still like finding bodies at this moment, and President Obama goes before cameras. He's got these pawns behind him, standing like, you know, these people, this woman with like a pearl necklace, you know, standing there like these, they're blinking the Morse code or something, the Morse code, you know, pearl clutching, and he. He starts off talking about this tragedy that happened in D.C., and then he segues to Syria, and he sort of dismisses it with that, saying, well, now that we've cleared up everything in Syria, now that we put that behind us. And then he basically gives a incredibly partisan political speech, bashing his political adversaries, while, it, you know, in the context of, you know, At this point, we believe that there are two other armed men on the loose in D.C., and there's blood and bodies being collected, and the president, with these, you know, staged pawns behind him, it was even putting aside the sort of inhumanity of this, it was just incredibly bad optics, and I think it speaks to a team that's certainly lost their mojo.
I have a different take, if you might expect. although I appreciate you, I mean, I can feel the sincerity in your attitude about this. I don't necessarily extend it to everyone making the comment, but I can hear it in your voice that I think you are truly offended by it. But I think a lot of folks who are criticizing Obama's posture here, in their very next breath, are making their own partisan rant about the budget fight, which is what this is really all about, and it's coming like a freight train in a few days, and both sides are jockeying for leverage about that. So I think there's a lot of disingenuity on the other side about this, but I think more fundamentally, this goes back to the 2008 financial crisis during the presidential campaign, when John McCain said, "We have to suspend the campaign and focus on the crisis." And Obama said, presidents have to walk and chew gum at the same time. You know, a president has to deal with multiple crises at a time, and you can't just block at everything else and focus on the one thing. And in this situation, there wasn't that much for him to do about the shooting in the hour that it first happened. And so to expect him to simply say, okay, forget about the fact that the government might shut down in 2 weeks. I have to stop working on that and talking about that, because I have to spend all of my time being the healing figure right now. That just doesn't make a lot of rational sense in my mind. And I don't think most people were offended by it. I understand you are and other people were. I don't get the sense in the media generally that there's been a national revulsion that Obama's handled it in this way. I think that,
you know, and there are certainly people like myself speaking out on this, and we talked about Morning Joe and others, but, you know, had this been George W. Bush, had, you know, had, you know, during Katrina, you know, or something, or let's take the Boston bombing, you know, which obviously happened during Obama's administration. But if a similar event had occurred and George W. Bush had given a political partisan speech attacking Democrats for something completely unrelated, I mean, I would have probably said that I would have probably been saying that it was unseemly and at very best inadvisable. I would have probably said, look, I think, you know, President Bush's heart was probably in the right place, but this is just really bad politics and just really bad optics. It gives the impression that he's not, you know, this is a solemn day. I mean, it's in the same city, for crying out loud, where this happened. You know, even giving him the benefit of the doubt, it just looks really, really bad.
The political risk is if there's a perception that there's something you should be doing that you are not doing because you're focused on something that's less important, you know, that would get you into trouble. If George Bush was making his umpteen speech about Social Security privatization, which was a bill that wasn't going anywhere, while the federal government was failing miserably to respond to Katrina, he'd have a big problem. But there isn't an argument at this point that the federal government didn't do what it was supposed to do in response to the shooting. There's some argument about what could have been done to catch the guy, but that kind of gets in the whole background check discussion and the sequester security discussion.
Yeah, but I disagree. I don't think it matters what, you know, whether or not he could have stayed home and watched a movie or something. That would have been preferable to this. I mean, it's not about whether or not he could have been doing something else. It's about respecting that a tragedy happened in the very city he's standing in, and just, you know, being solemn and not. It's just inappropriate to make a partisan. Tough partisan political speech within the context of something really horrific and tragic happening. And it's disrespectful. It's unseemly. Well, why couldn't you have just given the speech the next day? Just postpone it for one day out of respect for the people who are frankly still bleeding. I mean, my advice to him.
I mean, I don't think that it's seen as, I think most folks don't see it as any kind of disrespect to the people that have been killed. The fact that the government still has to function. There are things the government needs to do. One of them is to keep the lights on. And there are a group of people now who are determined to turn the lights off very soon. It's not like this is something that's like 2 years down the road. So he has to deal with that. So I don't think it's just a political speech. I mean, this is the speech that has actual policy relevance to, are we going to get these guys to stand down? Can I get the public to understand what these people are up to so they will stand down, not shut down the government, or worse, default on the debt? So I don't see it as being a trivial thing that he had to do instead. If my perception of it is not the broader public's perception, you'll see him have some weakened standing in this budget fight. I suspect you're not going to see that. I suspect that he is still going to have the upper hand. For all the reasons you said in the first half of the show, he's still going to have the upper hand in this discussion. And I don't think his one speech is going to turn the tables around for him.
Well, look, I think that overall, what we're seeing here is a sort of accretion, or rather, the opposite. I mean, well, an accretion of problems. I mean, look, passing a budget or keeping the government open is not a great accomplishment for a president. That is the minimum a president can do. I mean, but I do think that this speech is indicative of the tone deafness and the debacle in Syria, how it's been completely outmaneuvered by Putin and Russia and just neutered.
I'm happy to talk about that more, but at minimum, poll numbers show great pleasure with how that turned out. So I don't know if he's weakened his standing on the basis of that. We can talk about what you think is wrong on policy, but so far, yeah, the public is embracing it.
My point is simply is that I think that Obama has sort of entered the point where people have tuned him out. I don't think he's going to get anything else done, and I think that he's becoming increasingly out of touch.
I strongly disagree with that. I mean, I grant you, and we both agreed, you know, second terms are usually awful. He doesn't have a lot of accomplishments pocketed yet, although I would point out he did repeal the Bush tax cuts in large part. He did expand Violence Against Women Act for gays and lesbians. So he has a couple of things that he has gotten. There are executive orders that he is doing. For example, he just expanded wage protections for home health care workers, 2 million health care workers. So I think there's a lot of little things going on executively that could add up over time. The big executive one could well be the climate regulations that he's working on. That could well get done for the end of the term. And there's still foreign policy, which obviously is a lot of uncertainty, where you would consider that a net win or loss by the end of the second term. So I don't think he's you know, done. And immigration can still happen. And the way this budget battle turns out could change the trajectory of the presidency in a very big way. And if Republicans really crash and burn here, that could give him a whole extra shot on the arm, especially if it leads to the loss of the House Republicans. I'm not predicting it, but you certainly can't just write the whole term off yet because there's so much uncertainty here. So I don't buy that the public has tuned him out. I think his numbers do tend to sag when he doesn't have when the next accomplishment's not right around the corner, and his numbers sag when the gridlock persists, because there's always the hope that he's the person that's going to be the antidote to the gridlock, and he gets a degree of blame when that doesn't happen. But, you know, one accomplishment turns all that stuff around. I think his numbers have always kind of, you know, bobbed up along that way. So I think it's premature to say this, the lame duck is here. There's still a lot of irons in the fire.
We'll see. I guess the common theme is just a lack of leadership all around. Whether it's the President of the United States or the Congress, it doesn't seem to be a golden age for leadership and accomplishment.
There's no great golden age of presidents who have been seen as glorious leaders when the Congress is opposed to them, you know, when Congress is held by the opposite party, at least in part. You know, that's always an uphill battle. The great presidents that we've had have had gotten their achievements with their own parties in power, usually. So he's just in a different fighting posture, where he doesn't get to snap his fingers and get his way all the time. And even when parties have their own, when the president has their own party in power, you don't snap your fingers. It's still a bit of a slog, but it's less so than when you have to go up against the other party. So he's in the predicament he's in. I don't think that's a judgment on his leadership skills. If anything, he had enough leadership skills to get reelected despite not having a lot of accomplishments in the second 2 years of his term, because the opposite party was in charge. So he's leading somebody somewhere. And even with Syria, I know you don't like the way it turned out, but I think there is a strong argument to make that he led. You know, he didn't make himself beholden to UN procedure. He didn't make himself beholden to congressional procedure, even though he was prepared to submit himself to it, but he still made the military threat, regardless of all that, and forced Syria and Russia to buckle and admit they had chemical weapons and submit to limiting their stockpiles. Now, how that all turns out from here, again, there's a lot of uncertainty there, but, you know, 3 weeks ago, didn't even admit they had them. So,
well, look, let's go back and... I don't want to get into this again. Just go back and watch last week, where I think I said all I had to say about that. Bill, we're almost out of time, but I do want to ask you about that Peter Beinart piece in the Daily Beast last
week.
Which
the new left.
Right. It makes the argument that the New York mayoral race is potentially a harbinger of things to come, which could be bad news for Hillary Clinton. And could be good news for your junior senator, Bill.
Elizabeth Warren.
That's right.
But do you buy that?
Do you buy for those? You know, everybody should read this piece. Is he onto something, or is this just somebody looking to get, you know, to stir things up?
I think he's onto something. I don't buy the whole piece, lock, stock, and barrel. And I also point out there is a sort of follow-up pieces by Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post today. And there's a blog post in the Republic both making the same point. That's not just de Blasio, but it's also Summers having to stand down for the Fed and Bill Daley having to back off of running for Illinois governor, where, you know, Daley was being hit for his Wall Street ties. Summers was hit with his Wall Street ties. And de Blasio was hitting Bloomberg for not dealing with inequality.
Is Warren the senior senator now?
Yeah, she's a senior senator. I'm sorry. Yeah.
That sounds so bizarre, but okay. So you're a senior senator.
Right.
But what he's arguing is that millennials are very different, and that the Reagan and Clinton, those of us who know who Reagan and Clinton were, remember Reagan and Clinton, that we are operating under a worldview that has passed us by, and that there's sort of a next thing happening, and that's why Hillary Clinton could be sort of, once again on the wrong side of things.
Well, I think Beinart is extrapolating a little too much here. I mean, there is a point that there is a generation of young voters who have been brought up in the wake of a massive financial crisis that Wall Street induced, and they're not going to quickly forget. And therefore, sins of the past, like Larry Summers' role in deregulation in the 1990s, you know, ends up taking precedence over what Keynesian stuff he did at Obama's side. People forget about that and focus on the sins of the past. I agree that, what Bill Clinton did and what Obama had done in a different way was to try to defuse Wall Street and not make Wall Street be their outright enemy. You know, Clinton did sort of wholesale deregulation to keep them in check. Obama, I think, did more of a dance with them because he's still re-regulating Wall Street, but not taking it as far as some folks on the left would like. That the importance of keeping that marriage of convenience is less desired amongst younger voters right now. I think that's what Beinart is trying to say. I think that may well be true, but I think he is taking it a step too far to say Bill de Blasio's victory harbinges many electoral victories for the true blue left in the future, because this is a low turnout New York City Democratic primary with fairly weak opposition that doesn't tell you what's going to happen in Ohio or Colorado or Iowa or Texas or what have you. And, you know, the Summers battle was an inside the Beltway battle that the activist left got engaged in. I don't necessarily think the broader public weighed in on so much, but the activist left weighed in well enough that enough senators responded to that and communicated their attitude to the White House and Summers in the White House. Someone made Summers back down. Illinois I know less about, but it certainly seemed like, you know, Quinn, the current governor, was getting some good licks into Daley for his past background. But that's all, I think, pretty superficial. Beinart's taking it a step far to say, well, this means Hillary's got to watch out for a Warren type of candidate on her left. And I don't think Hillary is going to be dragged down by a Wall Street argument. And I don't think Hillary necessarily gets dragged down by a broader ideological argument. I think there's a lot of folks on the left that think Hillary transcends all of that. And a lot of it's going to depend on how Hillary carries herself if there is a primary. But I think Hillary gets a lot of elbow room for the fact that she has paid her dues and is seen as qualified as anyone could possibly be for the presidency, and doesn't feel like she's someone who's outright in opposition to liberalism, even if she's not going to be, you know, the farthest on the left. So I would expect that the Democratic Party is still going to be, you know, somewhat diverse ideologically on these issues, and there's going to be tensions and friction. But I don't see an outright civil war going on the way some have portrayed it. I think both Obama and Hillary have carried themselves in a way that keeps those divisions at a simmer. Unlike what's going on in the Republican Party right now, I don't see this breaking open in a big way, just because we've had, you know, just because the left has had some victories here.
Well, just remember, it's always darkest just before it's pitch black. So, all right, buddy, another award winning DMZ show. Take that, Crossfire. All right,
we'll catch- good to talk to you, Matt.
Good talking to you. We'll see you all back here next week in the DMZ.
Take care.
Peace.